likely to have a situation where we are trying to figure out how we're going to put everybody in. That's always wonderful, and it's a great privilege and pleasure to have His Eminence speaking with us today. Most of you know that we came from St. Barbara Monastery in Santa Paula, and some time back, about 2 years ago, His Eminence gave this basic talk there, and Mother Victoria said, oh, you have to have him come and do this here. So being very obedient nuns, we decided to go ahead and obey. So it's wonderful to have you here, Your Eminence. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Being a very obedient bishop, I'm here. So why don't we just pray our Heavenly King and go. Appear magically in one single moment, but it grew in time. The roots of the tree are to be found in Sinai, where God gave the great prophet Moses tablets of stone upon which were written the law. And the law was written, according to tradition, in God's own hand. And as the tree grew and as time passed, the tree experienced, as every other living thing does, change. The tribes that wandered about in the desert entered the promised land. They were ruled by judges, then by kings. What was once one kingdom divided later into two, and eventually both were obliterated through foreign invasion and captivity. And as everything does, this great tree, while remaining the same, adapted to the challenges of time and its environment. Father Schmemann used to say of the church, of the Orthodox Church, the church changes to remain the same. The only things that don't change are dead things, fossils. The church is not a fossil, it's a living organism. Finally, the tree grew into two branches, what we might call rabbinical Judaism and Christianity. They're not the same, but they have a common source and history. And while different, to understand one helps to have an appreciation of the other. There's an interesting fellow named Marcion of Sinope, and his dates are basically 85 to 160 AD. And he was considered himself to be a Christian bishop. He was not an Orthodox bishop, but he considered himself to be a bishop. And he's condemned as a heretic. But I want to tell you about his heresy. Marcion had this idea. He was a very, very modest man. He built his own church, and he had his congregation. And in his church, there were three statues. One was of Christ, one was of St. Paul, and one was of himself. Marcion had this idea that the God of the Old Testament, the God of the Passover, of the Angel of Death, the God that keeps telling people Israel to go out and subdue their neighbors and destroy this tribe and destroy that group, that was not the God of the New Testament. There are two different gods, and he rejected the Old Testament. In fact, another thing that he did was actually he decided that he didn't like all of the differences in the what we consider to be the traditional gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So he wrote his own gospel. Again, a very modest man, wrote his own gospel that kind of synthesized them all and worked out all the bugs. But he's considered to be a heretic, and one of the great reasons for this is simply his rejection of the Old Testament. Our church, if you just spend 5 minutes in church on Holy Saturday, you know that this church accepts the Old Testament. It has its understanding of the Old Testament that's different than Jews do, but we certainly embrace the Old Testament and the God of the Old Testament. Now there's a temptation among Christians and non-Christians alike to look at the final product and to think of Christianity like our friend Marcion, to think of Christianity as being something radically different from the Old Testament, as something new. I hope to point out and show today that Christianity, especially Orthodox Christianity, both in its worship and its theology, is the child of the Old Testament. It carries the very same genetic material, if you will. And an understanding of this connectedness, this shared heritage, can only serve to deepen our experience in the church and its liturgy. There exists an organic connection between our Orthodox Christian worship of today and the worship of the Apostolic Church, for sure. But also the organic connection between the worship of the first Christians, most of whom happened to be Jewish, and the worship of their forefathers exists. In both cases, worship is not contrived or invented. Rather, it grew out of something. And that something is the experience of those who were the people of God in an earlier time. And this is what we in the church call Holy Tradition, the breath of the Holy Spirit. A very important and critical thing we need to understand in this story is the year 70 AD. In the year 70 AD, there was a revolt in Palestine of Jews against the Romans. And the Romans sent troops to subdue this rebellion and destroyed Jerusalem and the temple. Now this was not the first time, and we're going to return to this story again, but this was not the first time that the temple was destroyed. If you will remember, when the Babylonians attacked Jerusalem, they also destroyed the temple, and they took away exiles to Babylon. This created a crisis in Judaism, which we'll discuss again later on, but I want you to be aware of it. And that was, if you have a religion that requires sacrifices in front of the Ark of the Covenant, what do you do if you don't have a temple anymore? What do you do if you don't have the Ark of the Covenant anymore? How do you remain a people? What do you do? Same thing happened in 70 AD with the destruction of the Jewish temple. When the general Pompey entered the Holy of Holies in the Temple of Jerusalem, he found it empty, except for a golden incense burner and a table. If there was no Ark of the Covenant, it was gone. And when they destroyed the temple, you know, they destroyed the worship of the second temple and as a result, Jewish life, as it was known. It cannot be overemphasized that ancient Christianity was not, as I said, something radically different. It was not some alien import, some invention. The ancient Christians and their forms of worship were and remain connected to forms of worship of their forebears enjoyed. In fact, and I will hope to touch on this later, I firmly believe that Christianity and not rabbinical Judaism is the continuation of the Judaism of Jesus' time, the direct line, if you will. And it is, in fact, the rabbinical Judaism, the Judaism that is widely practiced among Jews today, that is the diversion. It's, again, something you have to understand is that Judaism, when I grew up as a Protestant boy reading the Bible, you know, I had this idea that Judaism was this kind of monolith. God came down on Sinai, gave the law, and that was it. That's not true. I mean, there's a development. You first of all have the wandering in the desert, the tabernacle. Solomon builds a temple. It's a new home for the Ark of the Covenant. Then there's no longer a tabernacle, but there's a temple. There's rituals. The synagogue develops later on. So there's a development within Judaism itself. It's again a living, breathing organism. And modern rabbinical Judaism is a product of the post-temple period. As a friend recently phrased it, the Old Testament for Christians is like reading a crime novel or a mystery story. We have seen a dead body, a body on a cross, and the Old Testament contains in it the clues to this murder that tell you the whole story. The Old Testament can direct us to the evidence, as it were. But the clues were difficult to spot, or better to understand, or better to understand until we had the body. And for those first Christians, when they took a look at a second and third look at the Old Testament text, and this is important, the worship of the Old Testament, it all began to make sense for them. They began to understand what it was all about, how to understand those clues. I think the liturgy of the Great Sabbath, of Holy Saturday, is the perfect example of how we Christians understand those clues. If you've been in church on Holy Saturday, the liturgy is a vesperal liturgy, and it contains in it 15 Old Testament readings, which were an important part of the record. These contain the clues to the mystery of Christ, the Messiah, and they've been in Jewish scriptures all the time. Even the very idea of Sabbath, the day of rest, finally reveals its true and full meaning in the person of Jesus Christ. Why did God rest on the seventh day? Did he need to have a nap or some sort of divine vacation to recover from creation? Of course not. The Sabbath rest on the seventh day was instituted by God through Moses. We would say, Christians, because Christ would rest from his labors, from his work of salvation on the cross in the tomb on the seventh day. He would actively rest in the place where all the dead rested and were waiting for his arrival. He rested in a tomb on earth, and at the same time shattered the dominion of death, Sheol, as St. John Chrysostom so eloquently puts it in his sermon from Paschal Night. He, Christ, that was held by it, death, hath quenched it. He that descended into Sheol hath despoiled Sheol. He hath embittered it, which had tasted of his flesh. And Isaiah, anticipating this, one of the clues, saith, Sheol was embittered when it met thee below. It was embittered, for it was overthrown. It was embittered, for it was deceived. It was embittered, for it was slain. It was embittered, for it was cast down. It was embittered, for it was fettered. It took a body and encountered God. It took earth and met heaven. It took what it saw and fell upon what it saw not. At the liturgy of this presanctified gifts, there's a really curious moment. In the middle of all the readings of the Old Testament, we suddenly hear the deacon exclaim, command. And then the priest leaves the altar through the heavenly gates with a candle and exclaims, the light of Christ illumines all. It's kind of strange. It seems to have nothing to do with what we're in church for. It is said, however, to remind us that what we are reading in the Old Testament only makes sense finally and fully in the person of Jesus Christ, the Messiah, the promised one. Why is Jonah in the belly of the great fish for 3 days and nights, and why did he emerge unharmed? Because Jesus lay in the tomb 3 days dead and emerged unharmed. Why did Israel observe the Passover? Because Christ is our Passover, or Paschal Lamb, whose blood causes the angel of death to pass over us. The three children in the fiery furnace were unharmed by the flames because Christ was unharmed by death's grip. When I first, as a young man, came with my Russian class, I'll give you a little diversion. I tell you how I became Orthodox. I was studying Russian in high school. My grandfather was a minister in the Swedish Evangelical Covenant Church, and he spoke Russian. And he and my grandmother used to speak Russian when they didn't want us to know what was going on. They also spoke Swedish, but Swedish was kind of silly sounding, so I wasn't going to learn that. Yeah. So I went. My Russian class had a field trip, and we visited the Russian Cathedral in Los Angeles, Holy Virgin Mary Cathedral. It was the strangest place I'd ever seen. There were no chairs. There was some kind of contraption in the front of the church with pictures on it. I didn't see an organ. I couldn't imagine, how did these people worship? So I came back to visit that church the first Sunday I could drive. My parents would allow me to drive outside of town in my new car, which was this huge tank of a car. It was a Dodge station wagon with a straight six and, you know, a semi-automatic transmission. I think the steel was the thickness of tank steel. So I came to the church, and I came at 11 o'clock, which is when I always went to every church I ever heard of in my life. Church began at 11 o'clock. And all my life, we had big Sunday breakfast and didn't go to church. Well, boy, was I to be rudely disabused of that notion. So I came to the church and walked through the garden, and the liturgy was going on, and it was going on in Slavonic. I didn't understand a word. But I had the distinct impression that, number one, this was where God lived, and number two, that the service was not about me, but was about God, and it was, three, very ancient. In the Protestant church where I had grown up, all the hymns were kind of sentimental hymns about me. He walked with me, he talked with me, he tells me, you know, that kind of hymn. Just sentimental hymns basically about me. And here I was at a church where obviously, just simply by the position of the bodies, it wasn't about me. The priest was facing that way. The deacon was facing that way. The people were facing that way. Nobody was paying attention to me at all. And to tell you the truth, I went to the church for a year, stood in the back of the church, and no one ever talked to me, which is very Orthodox. But I would say the really significant thing for me, and probably the reason I became Orthodox, was because of the worship. For the first time in my life, I really seen worship. Worship that was about God. And the liturgy preserves this kind of sensibility, sensitivity, that was also part of Jewish worship at the time. We can say that what I observed that day was this organic connection between the past, which binds Orthodox Christians to their Jewish roots. One might say that to early Christians, Christian worship was fulfilled Jewish worship. Jewish worship illumined by the person of Jesus Christ. Now, how did the first Christians understand themselves? Did they understand themselves to be radically different from the Jews around them? The book of Acts in the second chapter gives us some very good clues. And all who believed were together and had all things in common. They sold their possessions and goods and distributed them to all as any had need. And day by day, attending the temple together and breaking bread in their homes, they partook of food with glad and generous hearts, praising God, and having favor with all the people. And the Lord added to their number, day by day, those who were being saved. There are three aspects of this passage I would like to draw to your attention. First of all, note that the first Christians continued to work in the temple, worship in the temple. Jesus had come, he had died, he rose from the dead, and yet the Christians still continued to go to the temple. That was the place where they worshiped, and always had. They did not see themselves as being anything more or other than Jewish. They continued to worship as they had worshiped before Jesus came. And there's an interesting reference to James, the first bishop of Jerusalem. A historical reference, I think it's given by Eusebius, where he says that James, who was the first, the leader of the Christians in Jerusalem, wore the vestments of the high priest. Kind of interesting. It's even more interesting when we understand that the word we translate as bishop, which is the leader of the local community in English, is actually the Greek term for high priest. In Greek, the bishop is archiereus, the high priest. James was the high priest of the first Christians of Jerusalem, who were ethnically Jews. He was of a priestly family, and it is reported that he wore the ephod, or the special breastplate of the high priest. Secondly, there's that little bit about the breaking of bread. This is a term that is used in early Christian literature to mean the Eucharist. Now, the Eucharist itself bears incredible similarities, at least in form, to a Jewish sacred meal, a Seder. Meals that are still part of Jewish Sabbath observances of pious Jews to this very day. It involves the breaking of bread and the sharing of a common cup. This is usually connected with a meal. Does that remind anybody of anything? You kind of see that the upper room. I always love the icons of the Last Supper. It's always interesting to see what's on the table, what they were eating. Sometimes you see carrots, sometimes you see little loaves of bread, sometimes you see, you know, fish, you know. But it's always interesting to me. But it's basically a Jewish family sacred meal. Now, I'd also like to turn your attention to the final sentence of this passage. And the Lord added to their number day by day those who were being saved. Please take note of the grammar here. Those who were being saved. One often hears today the question, are you saved? I ride the bus in San Francisco a lot, sometimes dressed like this. And if there's some, it's happened to me more than once, there's some little old lady among all the people on the bus decides to pick me out, sits next to me and says, are you saved? of all the people on the bus, you picked it. But what I always tell her is, I am being saved. To say I am saved means that it's a process that's completed. The tense here and in other places in the New Testament implies a process, something that is going on and is not completed. The verse which opens the third chapter of Acts and immediately follows the passage I just quoted, also reminds us of the early link Christians held, at least the apostles, with the Jewish cult. Now Peter and John were going to the temple at the hour of prayer, the ninth hour. It also is a passing reference to something else we inherited from the Jews, the idea of the sanctification of time, or hours of prayer. Have you ever heard of the ninth hour in the Orthodox Church? Of course, it comes right before Vespers. We also have the first hour, the third hour, and the sixth hour. It's this idea of the sanctification of time, prayer at certain times of the day. Just as in the temple, sacrifices were offered at certain times of the day. The temple cult also had marked special observances during the year, suffering special sacrifices and prayers and holidays. We have that very same custom in the Orthodox Church. And it is to be found among all the ancient family of the family of ancient Christian churches. And here I mean most of all to exclude the churches of the Protestant world, because their observances are relatively new. Let me kind of take a little diversion there. Protestantism depends upon the book. What does a Protestant person do? They read the Bible, usually on their own. They interpret it them. They find the church they want to go to, and they go there. But it's a very book-based understanding of faith. It's also a faith that's impossible without the printing press. It's the printing press that made it possible for individuals to own copies of Scripture. Jews didn't own private copies of the Scriptures. They didn't. You might have one or two books. You might have a book in this synagogue and a scroll in that synagogue. But to have the entire collection there was something that only extremely wealthy people could afford, because everything had to be copied by hand. So Jews went to the synagogue, they went to the temple to hear the Scriptures chanted, to hear them proclaimed. Not because somebody was trying to hide something from them, was trying to keep things from them, but it was the only place that you could really share the Scriptures, could hear them, was in the context of the service. And it's very interesting. Another thing that we inherit from the Jews is this idea of the chanting of Scriptures. In the Orthodox Church, for the most part, when we hear Scriptures, we hear them read this way. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth was without form and void, right? It's kind of that kind of melodic way of singing. It's a kind of vocal equivalent of reading a text. If I'm chanting something, I cannot alarm you or impress you by my spiritual state. If I start saying, "And the Lord came," and, you know, I'm giving you my dramatic or traumatic impression of the Scriptures, right? I'm giving you my interpretation of what I think is really important. And that puts me between you and the Scriptures. But when you chant them, you render them objective, vocally. I can't tell you what is the most important thing by the inflection of my voice. And there are very few times, at least in the Russian tradition, that you will find reading done without being chanted or reading according to a special melody. One of them, by the way, is on Holy Saturday. It's kind of the tradition in the Russian church to read the Ezekiel prophecy, the dry bones, in a special way. It can be rather dramatic, which is kind of fun, but it's the one time of year that we do that. But one came to the synagogue, one comes to church before there's a printing press to hear the Scriptures, and then to hear the churches or the synagogues, the communities' understanding of those Scriptures. They belong to the community. They don't belong to individuals. They're the result of the community. We have that. Interesting, remember that there was all that when the Da Vinci Code came out. Oh, we found another gospel. It's a gospel of Judas. Oh my gosh, we didn't know he wrote one. Well, you know, how stupid. That's if you get all of your information about religion from the National Enquirer, you know, that was a great revelation for you. But actually, we've known about these books and rejected them for centuries. They were known and they rejected them. I mean, the three bears we've known about. And we didn't include them into the canon of Scriptures. You know, it's just not part of the canon of Scriptures. And so, it's the church, it's the community, it's the people of God that say these are the books and these aren't the books. It's the tradition of the church that says these are the books of the Bible and these books aren't. It's, and it's always been that way. We're going to talk about the Jewish canon of Scripture later because it's very important.